IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Welcome to All Things Policy, folks. These are challenging times economically for India and for the world at large as well. One much touted economic opportunity for India has been this idea of drawing investments from companies that are looking to exit China. Now, there might be some good political and economic reasons for at least some private enterprises to leave China, or at least to hedge their bets. But we'll, how many of those companies are actually leaving China is an interesting question. But as the theory goes, these companies will leave China and they'll find a more welcoming home in India. Now, obviously, it's a lot more complicated than that. And so I'm really thankful that I have my colleagues here at Takshashila who've put together this very brief and very readable document that analyzes the opportunities and also how India can take advantage of them. We'll have a link to the document in the show notes, but I'm going to start by welcoming two of the authors, Manoj and Sarthak. Hi, guys.
Hi, Aditya. Hi, Manoj.
Hey, Aditya. Hi, Sarthak.
Hey. So, I we'll start with a bit of big picture. Manoj, you know, your document proposes a combination of two approaches, one in which India collaborates with like-minded countries in some critical areas that have national security implications. And two, you argue that India should identify specific sectors in which it has a comparative advantage. You know, that's the normal economic reasoning for such a shift in supply chains. Now, obviously, the world has changed quite dramatically in the last few years. You know, we no longer talk about free trade like we used to. We no longer obsess over the Doha round of talks and so on. China, rising political tensions and the pandemic have all changed things. We've even been told that the ongoing pandemic was actually a economic boon in disguise. But Manoj, can you first just walk us through what these critical changes have been to what some used to argue was this inevitable march of globalization? And how has that economic environment changed?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question, right? I mean, if you go back to, say, five, 6 years ago, we were already hearing about changes taking place within the Chinese economy. And I'm sure Sarthak will talk about these in much more detail than I can talk about them. But I mean, just an overview, you were hearing about at least labor costs rising. You were hearing about the Chinese government itself saying that it wants to move to high quality growth. And, you know, this low quality manufacturing, low end manufacturing is unsustainable. And companies were sort of talking about the lack of competitiveness and so on and so forth. So there was already some sort of a churn happening. And the idea was that, well, India could gain from these sort of changes. And India was not the only one that could have gained from these changes, but many others could have also. In China itself, there was a conversation, and there has been a conversation for a very long time about shifting from export-driven growth to consumption-driven growth. And that conversation today has much more steam than ever, with today there being a specific strategy. The details of the strategy are thin, but at least at a sort of level of the leadership, you know that they want to now decisively move towards consumption and demand-driven growth in China. So these were trends that were already existing. On that, you bring things like, the US-China trade war. And if you think of it in that context, when Trump started imposing those tariffs and when tensions about technologies began to rise, you started to see some sort of disruptions taking place. You know, more companies were starting to, the comparative advantage of being in China started to become much more challenging for these companies. So at the same time, you started talking about, well, okay, do you want to move out of China entirely or do you want to hedge your bets? Because, you know, Trump may be a factor which goes away after a certain point of time, which like we're seeing right now as a factor, Trump has gone away. But yet, you know, there's a move towards of American policy in a certain direction. So companies would then sort of start to look at hedging our bets because politics is, I mean, the president is just sort of a product in some ways of politics. That's a groundswell of politics against international trade in the West. So you were seeing these trends already playing out. And even before the pandemic, if one remembers, you could hear talk in India about leveraging the trade war and attracting businesses to India. I mean, one part of this, even before this trade war began in India, was this context of, you know, we need to improve infrastructure, we need to expand ease of doing business in India, and that will make India much more attractive. And then the trade war sort of gave greater fillip to all of that. And if you go back to 2019, you can go and read reports about, you know, the government putting together dossiers with different ministries about, and even asking states to be part of this conversation about how you can attract foreign investors. In 2019, August, there was a report about how the government has identified a set of, quote, target companies that it would look to incentivize specifically in order to set up bases in India. And these were across different sectors, telecom, pharmaceuticals, folks like Apple. And the idea was that, you know, you make India a much more attractive destination, particularly using the fact that things in China might not be that much better for these companies. Now, in that sense, yes, there was an opportunity. But in a larger sense, what all this was telling us was that, you know, the sort of philosophical idea that was underpinning economic globalization, that, you know, comparative advantage produces great efficiency, and eventually if you have free trade, you will also have the states being bound in this cycle of prosperity and peaceful coexistence. You know, I can remember long ago, there was this phrase that I had used in one of my, I think it was in my college, where I used it in one of the sort of elocution contests, the idea that, you know, borders frequented by trade seldom see conflict. To me, that sort of has started to change, right? Increasingly, interdependence became weaponized. And it was not just Donald Trump who did it, but even before that, the Chinese were doing it. And it's become far more intensely weaponized. Now, within all of this melee, you look at three specific factors, right? One is China's economic rise in itself, which shifts sort of balance of power around the world. The other is the authoritarian turn in Chinese politics that is accompanied by this rise. Xi Jinping's authoritarianism does not just impinge on domestic politics, but it has a significant impact on how China conducts its foreign policy. And that starts to have an impact. There's a populist backlash in the West to economic globalization, which we have seen, which even with Trump going, is not going to go away. And finally, you see this competition over new technologies, which again is structural, strategic, and will remain. On all this, you eventually get the COVID-19 pandemic. And then you start worrying about, okay, things are shutting down. How do you maintain supply chain resilience? You know, if China or any other country is critical to your auto or car making supply chain, and if it shuts down for a month and a half or 2 months, it causes downstream effects and you end up having significant losses and disruptions. So people talk about building resilience and redundancies. More so when you see the pandemic and you see, if you go back to February and March and April, and the rush for face masks, sanitizers, ventilators, and the insane amount of orders that the Chinese manufacturers for these got. And the questions about China's dominance of some of these areas, some of these products, leads to discussions about, well, are we looking at too few areas as critical to national security? Because what the pandemic tells us is that healthcare is one area which is critical to national security. So your definition of national security becomes far more broader. And there are more sectors that are now going to be looked at. And last but not, sort of not the least is the idea that, can you be dependent and vulnerable on a single market, not just to be your supplier, but also to be in some ways your consumer? For many of the Western firms, China is a key consumer. And that then creates another set of tensions. And then lastly, when you have your own sort of insecurities, when your markets are down, you start to worry about how do you secure your investments, because your companies are suffering record losses, yet your investment climate is absolutely free. And you can see people come and pick off some of your leading technology and technology firms and innovative enterprises for you know, bargain buys. And do you want to do that? And so you see more barriers being erected. Essentially, what all this tells us is that economics and economic decision making is no longer sort of the primary criteria based on which states or firms will make decisions. Increasingly, politics is critical to all of this, and that is undergirded by the idea of trust. If you trust a partner, you're likely to do much more. And that trust is political trust. So that's essentially the big picture of what we are seeing emerge.
Thanks, Manoj. That's a really nice summary of what we've seen over the last few years. I'm glad you brought up this whole idea of, the cliche of when goods don't cross borders, armies will, or the reverse, when goods cross borders, armies stay at home. I don't think anybody makes that argument very seriously anymore. You've talked about how companies are considering their options again. And here I want to bring in Sarthak. Sarthak, if you're a company deeply invested in China, why would you really be thinking about getting out? What would be some good reasons for thinking about that?
Yes, Aditya, it's a nice question. Now, before thinking of exiting, I would first evaluate, right? What are the things that I'm getting in China, right? So what are the advantages that China offers? And again, what are some of the things that I'm not getting here, or what are those things which I can get somewhere else? If they are better, then I might consider exiting out. Now, what China offers to firms, what China offers to entrepreneurs? Now, China is the most populous country. And so it's a huge market. And it's not just about the population, right? They also have a huge chunk of population which is affluent. Like there are somewhere around 400 million people in China whose incomes is almost at par with the European standards. So if you are targeting European markets, it's equivalent to targeting China as well, right? Similar kind of income levels are there. And on top of that, the incomes have been consistently increasing. They're increasing at some 8% per year for the last four decades. So you have a large market, and again, people are becoming affluent. That means your chances of selling your products, goods, services is much higher. Apart from that, China, I mean, if I'm an entrepreneur, I will try to find out places where I can get capital. And China has that. It has the largest banking system. It has one of the largest stock markets, bond markets. And also, government subsidizes the domestic firms. And it has also made announcements that it is going to subsidize, or it will be funding some private firms as well. On top of that, look at the capability of Chinese people. Maybe 2-3 decades back, you would rarely find Chinese university among the top universities, among the highly ranked universities world over. But over a period of time, the number of universities in these top 100 ranks, it has increased. Number of PhDs that they are churning out has increased massively. Number of papers, the number of patents, all these things has increased massively. So there is this entire ecosystem which is promoting technology. So the technological capability of Chinese people, that has also increased massively, and you have that entire ecosystem. On top of that, China is at the epicenter of the global value chains. And if you look at the Asian economies, again, China is very well connected with other Asian economies, both forward, backward linkages there. So if I'm an entrepreneur, these are the advantages that China offers me. But over a period of time, things have also changed. Different kind of risks, as Manoj also pointed out, have come up. Like, for example, the state over there has been intruding into the business. And in recent times, you would have come across that news, right? Jack Ma's Alibaba and the Communist Party, those kind of things. So as an entrepreneur, I will always be wary of different kind of political risks. So if I'm investing in China, these kind of risks can be there. Intervention of the Communist Party into the enterprises or the business, different kind of business activities. So that is one major risk. On top of that, as Manoj also pointed out, that health is becoming one of those things which needs to be given more importance in the aftermath of the pandemic, and how we have seen the long supply chains that we have had. If you had shorter supply chains, maybe things would have been different for different countries. So certain kinds of goods and services will be given more importance, and maybe we will be dependent on shorter supply chains rather than these long extended supply chains, which is spanning throughout the world. Apart from that, US-China trade war in the last couple of years, it has incentivized firms to look for an alternate base as well. They would want to harness the markets that exist in China, but they would also want to have another base somewhere else, so that they don't want to put all the eggs in the same basket. Why should we have why should we concentrate the risk, rather distribute it? So many countries, many firms they are preferring to have that China plus one strategy. That means one base having China, and then again maybe have some other bases somewhere else. Apart from that, we have been hearing a lot that the labor cost in China is quite low, the wages are quite low. But over a period of time, as Chinese economy is improving, that means supply of labor, that is also getting reduced. And as the supply of labor will get reduced, the price that you pay for labor, the wages, that is also going to increase. So over a period of time, the wages have also increased, which used to be one of the comparative advantage. If you are investing in China, then you can produce things at a cheaper price because the wages were less, but now that has also changed. And on top of that, Chinese government, they're also coming up with different kind of regulations, especially environmental regulations. And if you have to adhere to these environmental regulations, which is again important, but at the same time, your cost increases, right? Cost of production increases. So you might not be as competitive as you were in the past. So I will look at all these new kind of things as well as an entrepreneur, all these new kind of issues, challenges, risks, and I will compare it with the advantages. So maybe when you are evaluating all these things, maybe you will find some destinations which are better than China. So again, these kind of things we have studied here. So positives are there, negatives are there, and then which are the countries which firms might prefer, whether the firms might prefer India over China, all these things we have studied in details.
Can I add something here?
Yeah, please.
So I think what Sarthak has explained really well are the reasons for why companies should have chosen to be in China, or why they might consider leaving China. But I mean, and all of this is in the document that we've written, but what's not in the document that we've put together is data on what exactly are firms doing, right? Because some of this that we're talking about are, you know, preferences that we assume, but what do sort of stated revealed preferences of firms show us? And like Sarthak said, right, you know, there's this China plus one strategy that most companies we believe will be looking at. And some of the data sort of bears this out, right? You know, earlier last year, sort of Japan announced this $2 billion or some subsidy for firms to relocate. And then initially it was about relocating back to Japan. But then it was about, you know, okay, you can go to other places, and then it identified different areas where you can go to. And if you're relocating there, you can avail the subsidy. And India, Bangladesh, parts of Southeast Asia are other places where these subsidies are valid. Yet what we've seen is that it's not necessarily been the case that lots of firms have, you know, a lot of them have applied, but, you know, the outcomes in terms of how much you've relocated, what you've done, has been fairly mixed. It's not like there's been a mass exodus in one way or the other. Likewise, I mean, just through this past year, surveys of American, European, and British firms in China tell you a story of how these firms are not necessarily terribly keen to relocate. And part of this is that they may look at a China plus one strategy, but they're not willing to sort of necessarily even exit China. I'll just give you some data points. The AmCham Shanghai's September 2020 survey found that around 78.6% of companies in China don't plan to change their investment allocations. So this is just investment allocations. Forget even relocating. So if you thought that you're going to spend something, you're going to continue spending that. That's not even a reduction in what you were going to spend. In contrast, the European Chamber of Commerce in China survey in February this year, which was again redone, published later in the year, finds that only about 11% of firms are considering shifting their current or planned investments to other markets. Again, a very small firm. The survey also says that most European firms in China are in there for the Chinese market. So it makes really no sense for them to move out. Then later in the year, in October, there was a survey, I think not October, towards the end of the year, there was a survey of British firms in China. And that said that only 3% were considering leaving China completely. So there's no mass exodus happening. So even in that case, you know, what you are going to look to attract is not a huge amount of sort of huge set of companies. So therefore, one needs to be far more strategic. And I'm sure Sarthak will tell us a little bit about what, you know, where India stands with regard to other markets, because our competition is not just China.
Yeah, so I mean, we have to look at two things here. If let's say firms are moving out of China, again, we don't have much evidence for that. Very few firms have actually moved out. Even if, let's say, they're considering moving out of China, so they have multiple options, right? One is India, and then there are other countries also where they can probably move out. So two ways we can evaluate it. First, compare India's comparative, what is India's comparative advantage with China, and then compare India's comparative advantage with other Asian economies or whether other economies where there can be movement of firms from China. Now, the first part, if you look at India and China, again, there are we have looked at different data. For example, we looked at the World Economic Forum's data, and there you find that along most of the indices, if you compare different kind of factors, for most of the factors, China is much better than India. For example, if you take infrastructure, if you take the markets, if you take the financial systems, innovation capacity, in most of these criteria, China performs much better than India. Some areas where India has an advantage is maybe we provide more freedom in some sense. But again, if you look at efficiency and all these things, China performs much better. Now, if you compare India with different other economies, especially the Asian economies, there also we don't find India doing better. Many of these countries, Singapore, Malaysia, Taiwan, Thailand, Vietnam, they are performing much better. So we have data from Rabobank, we have data from Nomura. All of them find out that if companies will be moving from China, they might prefer these countries rather than India. So India will be coming somewhere on 4th, 5th in that list of priority. It is not among the top countries where firms would want to relocate.
Yeah, so it would appear that, you know, this is a fairly small pie that we're talking about.
Yeah.
And even for India to get a chunk of that pie will be a challenge because, you know, when those firms leave China, they might be looking at other more interesting new places to go and settle down. What are some of the advantages that India has in this? You know, is there something that would draw companies to India instead of, say, a Vietnam or any other Southeast Asian country?
The biggest advantage, I would say, is the market. I mean, India has that. I mean, India has a huge market that probably all these economies will not have. But when it comes to other parameters, especially when it comes to the efficiency-related parameters, India doesn't do well. But yeah, markets are something which are much better. The size of the market, basically. We are a huge country, second largest population. So that is the major advantage that India has.
All right. Now, you guys put together a set of approaches. You have a framework for how India can approach what opportunities are available and how India can react to ongoing geopolitical trends. Can you walk us through it? Because you talk about an efficiency-based approach, case by case, looking at risk and a geostrategic approach. Just tell us how you came to this particular framework for approaching the problem.
Okay, so what we did was that we thought about, what are the ways in which, I mean, given the sort of scenario that we've painted, right, that there is India's comparative advantage isn't as strong, isn't as significant, and there is enough sort of impetus for firms to stay in China from an economic point of view or even from an economic indicators point of view to move to other places, which might offer far more efficiency. Yet there is a change in terms of the geopolitics of, you know, everything. And therefore, there is a political advantage that India can bank on. So we thought about what are the ways in which and what do firms look at, what are states looking at, and what are the sort of key parameters in their decision making. Based on that, we basically came at four approaches. And then we ranked those approaches on two parameters. One was how easy it would be to do this in the short run. Comparatively, of course, none of this is going to be easy. And what is the impact, again, in terms of attracting foreign investment in the short run? So this is therefore a short run perspective. What we did was therefore we came on four big ideas, right? The first is making the economic argument, right? So if you're an Indian diplomat and you're going out and you're making the argument to attract foreign investment into your country, you go and make the economic argument and say, look, India needs to become a global manufacturing hub. We have skills, we have talent, we have opportunity, we have a market and so on and so forth. And that was the idea. Yet, as Sarthak has spoken already, that, you know, this is, we're sort of on weak footing when we make that argument. There are some strengths that we have, yet largely, you know, is going to be challenging to make that argument. And if that was an argument that was self-evident, we would have already been seeing lots of foreign investment coming into India, you know, despite sort of years and years and years of right now Make in India, but before also other sort of initiatives, we haven't seen the kind of money come in. And that's evident, right? And therefore, we thought that, look, this is not really going to work. Yet it is critical for India to work towards making this argument self-evident. So in the long term, this is the argument that's going to sustain us, an efficiency-based approach, where we undertake factor market reforms, we improve the investment climate, we improve infrastructure, and those are going to help us in good, or keep us in good stead in the long run. In the short run, apart from it not being, it being extremely difficult to sort of bear fruit in the short run, it's also extremely difficult to do. And we're seeing that with the sort of conversation that we are having on, say, farm laws right now in India. Or, you know, the conversation that we had earlier last year on labor regulation changes. These are tricky things. And if you do them by fiat, which is what was attempted, it's going to create far more turbulence. So you need to have a deeper conversation, and parliament needs to sort of enact legislation to change all of this. And right. Then states need to sort of play a role. So this is a long-term prospect, and therefore in the short run, you're not going to take advantage of the current geopolitical environment by doing this. The next thing was we looked at a case-by-case approach. Now, this was essentially identifying which are the sectors in which India enjoys comparative advantages, right? So at a broad economic level, we might not be as competitive in certain sense as, say, Vietnam or Thailand or whatever else. But in certain sectors, we have skills. And this is where essentially the labor is skilled. We've got the processes in place and we've actually been doing very well. So something like pharmaceuticals, something like auto, gems, gem design, biotechnology, etc. I mean, those are the kind of areas where we are already doing well. And if you can see in each of these, there's a certain skill level that's required. Low-end manufacturing, we're not really doing all that well. So we thought that, okay, these are places where we already have strengths. We can actually make the economic argument in this case. And we can also leverage the political environment to attract far more investment here. So this might actually be a fairly good idea to do. The challenge here is that in order to do this, you have to also provide incentives to industrial companies in these sectors. And that in some ways involves the government picking winners and losers. You're saying that I'm going to prioritize this over other things. And that might sort of not hold, you know, that might not sort of sound morally, you know, well from in a democratic country.
It will also probably cause economic distortions of, you know, of an unexpected kind.
Yeah. Exactly. So those are the kind of things that we need to worry about when we do something like this. And the other issue is that knowing that these are areas in which you need higher skill, higher skilled workforce, you're not going to have a broader employment generation impact by doing this. You know, so it's not going to create mass employment like low-end manufacturing will, yet you will create employment in certain sectors, but it will be for slightly higher skilled individuals. So that's the sort of flip side of this argument, but still worth doing and worth sort of considering. The third logic that we looked at was a risk-based approach. Here it was to essentially look at which are the areas in which, you know, what are the places in which people are talking about supply chain resilience. And actually use that to say, look, if you want to build resilience, you come to India. We can be an attractive alternative. And this was, again, looking at all firms who are just considering hedging their risks. You know, whichever sector, wherever you are, just look at hedging their risks. And it's a good idea to do this. You emphasize political trust as opposed to economic logic. You may end up actually getting some firms coming here. But again, the economic challenges sort of remain, right? I mean, if you're looking at, again, low-end manufacturing, or if you're even looking at some place where India does not necessarily have the sort of comparative advantage, whether it's garments, whether it's textiles, whether it's shoes or anything like that, while you're making the argument that, you know, come and invest here, this can be your space for resilience, the economic imperative may just not be strong enough, you know, and the threat faced by some of these manufacturers may not be as significant for them to want to take that chance to relocate in India, which may not be a cost-effective decision. The other issue is that you will have to keep making those economic changes to be able to make it worth the while of these individuals. That will require you to maintain political stability, policy predictability, And if you are also drifting towards a place where you're saying Atmanirbharta and we don't want to be part of international trade agreements, it can be far more challenging, right? It sullies the environment and it makes the decisions for these businesses far more difficult. Would you want to come to an India which is not as open to exports or where exports are far more problematic, or even where imports are problematic because you are going to be part of international supply chains? And if India is out of agreements, then it might be difficult for these firms to enter India. So that's the pros and cons of the risk-based approach. And the final approach that we looked at was a geostrategy-led approach. Now, this essentially talks about working with partners, which are states, who are concerned about the strategic implications of China's dominance of key supply chains. This is essentially focusing on a very narrow range of sectors where national security has become far more critical. I say narrow, yet it's a significant number of these, right? We've already spoken about pharmaceutical APIs. You can think of rare earths. You can think of the broad healthcare sector. You can think of telecom and then emerging technologies, things like new energy vehicles and so on and so forth. There's a range of these sectors where national security implications are being redefined. And I think that's where you can actually go and make a pitch and say, look, this is where you invest in India and you work with us on grounds of national security. So that incentivizes governments in partner states to sort of incentivize their companies to come and invest in India on grounds of national security rather than investing in China. And we've seen some of this talk, at least from the US and other players, but this could be an interesting thing to do because it also creates not just investment in India, but also creates innovation opportunities in India and could potentially aid that. The big challenge of doing this is, and I'm sure that somebody in India will make this argument, is that, oh, once you start to do this, you start to create critical dependencies with regard to sort of key sectors of national security, such as, say, telecom.
Yeah.
And that will undermine India's strategic autonomy. Now, to me, that's an overstated argument, but I'm certain people will make it. We've already heard it being made with regard to 5G. But I think what people miss out is that, you know, any of these partnerships are products of mutual interdependence, mutual sort of trust and interdependence and mutual interest, and either side can leverage it. So, you know, and what we should be looking at is the cumulative outcome of what it does to Indian innovation, Indian development. And I think in that it's a plus. So I don't think we should worry too much about that. Yet what will be challenging to do this is to identify what components of these partnerships you want to do, what components are cost-effective to do in India, how do you harmonize rules and standards, particularly when you're talking about new technologies, how do you, there is a give and take that India will have to do. For example, if India can't talk about digital sovereignty, data sovereignty, while talking about building a quadrilateral technological alliance, you know. So you have to change some of these, you have to give up some of these ideas and you have to harmonize some of these things. And I think that's a bit of a trade-off that we'll have to make. So those were the four broad approaches that we looked at. How we assessed them, like I said, was on parameters of impact and implementation. Of course, an efficiency-based approach will have the greatest impact, provided you can do it tomorrow, but or even in a year. But I don't think it's really going to happen in a year. And therefore, it's extremely tough to implement. In contrast, we assessed that a geostrategy-led approach, given the current political climate, and a case-by-case approach, which leverages the political climate along with your comparative advantages across sectors, might be the most easy to implement and still give you good returns. And at the end of the day, as you start to get these returns and you can demonstrate victories in one or two sectors, it sort of allows you to then go out and make a broader case to even more companies to come. That look, if X can succeed, of course you can do. It's not that complicated to navigate the labyrinth of Indian policy and state. So I think that's the argument that we are making. A combination of a geostrategy-led approach and a case-by-case approach will likely bear the most fruit in the short run and will likely be easier to implement. And that is what we are recommending that the policymakers in India do.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting because, like you said, Manoj, there's no real substitute in the long term, perhaps, for an efficiency-based approach, but that's going to be the hardest thing for India to do. Sarthak, do you have any final thoughts on this?
So I think Manoj has brilliantly summarized the entire thing. But yeah, as he pointed out, that whatever we are suggesting, this is more of a short-term thing. And we should not be following the shortcuts, right? So right now we can probably go ahead with these things, but over a period of time, we have to find out ways by which India becomes more efficient. India becomes one of those destinations which attracts investments. And for that, we have to ensure that we have macroeconomic stability, we have policy stability. Generally, what happens is our policies keep on changing. We have seen that happening multiple times. Our tax laws keep on changing with, again, a retrospective effect. So all these things need to be taken into consideration. Factor market reforms, again, we have to focus on this. Infrastructure development has to be given priority. We have seen how we do not have a sufficient number of ports. Again, the capacity of the ports have not been revamped over a period of time. Airports, again, they also do not have sufficient capacity for, again, cargo movement and all. So we have to build on this. And again, last but not the least, human capital. That's also important. India is known for lower wages, but that should not be the final thing, right? We have to ensure that our labor is sufficiently productive as well. It's not just about low cost of labor. Productive labor is more important. So if a firm is paying for labor, then they also should get the right kind of return out of it. So all these things will not happen overnight. We have to build our capacities along all these lines, and it will take time. And this is what has to be taken up. This is what has to be done in the long run. So yeah, these are the structural reforms that we should be aiming for.
Yeah, absolutely. Your document is a cold blast of reality for anyone imagining that, you know, there are these great economic opportunities just awaiting India. There's obviously no substitute for investing in our own capabilities and building them over the long term. So thank you so much, guys.
Thanks, Aditya. Thanks, Manoj.
Thanks, guys.
And like I said, we will have a link to this document in the show notes. And thank you all for joining us on All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week, Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.